Salvation Hour. This is your host, Marshall.
I'm Cole.
I'm Jennifer.
And I'm Daryl.
As you may have surmised, we are here with Daryl Ray, author of one of my favorite books, The God Virus. One of the few books that I've actually read twice, which I really have. I enjoyed it.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Lots of people have enjoyed it.
I'd really rather you buy it twice, but go ahead and read it.
I may have, you have to sign it twice.
No, I only bought it once. It was money well spent. I bought it for $20. You gave a speech at a humanist meetup, and I was
that was
there.
Heartland Humanists.
Heartland Humanists.
Mooney, Joanne.
Yeah, we all went out for drinks afterwards,
right.
And then the second was that was a second actually. You did K.
Yeah, I did K's
K.
First.
That's where you and I met the first time.
Yeah,
first K.
Time.
Yeah.
I feel like I should warn the audience that some of us have been drinking.
Like all of us. But we've been eating crackers and
Cole's
cheese.
Cole's been drinking. None of the rest of us have.
Well, hey, I would never not admit
he
to
can't
that.
Can't even talk.
Pour me another one.
So,
where's that ice?
So, author of The God Virus. Great book. I understand that, if I'm correct, correct me if I'm wrong, Richard Dawkins is reading it. Said he was about to read it.
He actually downloaded it and was reading it as he interviewed me last week for his new documentary that's coming out. I don't know when it's coming out, but it's on sex and religion. And he came into Kansas City and interviewed me for about an hour and 15 minutes.
Hopefully.
But, yeah, but he had downloaded The God Virus and was reading it. I don't know if he likes it or not. Well, no, I should say he told me he liked it. So we'll
okay.
take,
so
we'll
you
take
do
it
know.
Face,
you know.
We'll take it at face value. I'm not sure.
It's a great book. And I'm not just saying that. I really did enjoy it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
It is good.
It stands
is good
up
book.
To Dawkins, but it's pretty dumb.
Well, there's been a lot of our members that's come in from R&R and other groups that have read it and enjoyed it, especially for one of their first books.
I have to say it's probably number two with me behind Hitchens' book.
God's Not Great.
Great.
Wow, number two behind Hitchens?
Oh, praise the Lord.
That's my God.
Maybe not on Amazon, but with me, you are.
What has been the number one rated book on atheism on Amazon for almost 2 years.
Wow.
It?
Wow.
Yeah,
cool.
It's number one. I mean, rated, not selling, but rated.
Right.
And it stayed in the top 10 to 20,000 out of 6 million books. It's staying
that's
right
wow.
in there.
Pretty
so it's staying
good,
in the top
yeah.
1% of all the books sold on Amazon.
Wow.
But I think the thing I'm most happy about is the rating. I mean, it gets right. pretty much a 4.6% 4.6 star rating.
Sure.
It's nice.
Yeah, that's important.
Sadly, I cannot rate it since I bought it from you directly.
Well, if
you
got
go
an
on
account, if you got an account on Amazon, you can.
Yeah.
Oh, they don't require you to buy the book to rate it?
No, you just
don't
have to have
so.
An account on Amazon.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We'll do that.
Yeah,
I really
heck,
enjoy.
I'd love to get more reviews on there. We have 90 reviews right now. Actually, I have more reviews and higher reviews than like Dan Barker or Hitchens. It's
wow.
got higher
wow.
higher ratings than Hitchens has.
That's.
I wish I could say I sold as many as Hitchens has.
Right. But that's good. That's
yeah,
that's
it's very good. Yeah,
that people take the time to do that.
Yeah, I never thought it would sell as many copies as it sold. Just way off the chart.
I mean, I get you know you've kind of become within the United States a bit of a luminary among the free thinking communities. You're pretty well known throughout the country.
Well, I hope that's a compliment.
As long as the law's not looking for you, right?
Well, you know, a Christian might not have viewed that as a compliment. I viewed it as a...
My family doesn't.
So anyway, we didn't bring you here. Actually, we're here.
Yeah, we brought us here.
We're not here in your basement to talk about a book you
My
wrote.
My recording studio.
To talk about a book that you wrote. How long ago did you write that? 3 years ago?
Almost 3 years ago.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Ago.
That's amazing.
We are here to talk about, kind of to do a bit of a review, or our take, upon the recent sex survey that you put out. You and...
Amanda Brown.
She's a graduate of KU.
No, she's an undergraduate of KU.
Oh,
and
undergraduate.
Her husband is the one that runs Atheist...
Resource.com.
Okay.
And it's an excellent website for
yeah,
any
it is.
Atheist.
It is. It's great.
Here
it's a lot of fun.
Here
yeah. yeah.
Right
yeah.
here. Yeah.
Yeah, he has some fun articles.
We're talking here to talk about your sex survey. And what is the title again?
Sex Survey.
Sex and Secularism. What happens when you leave religion? A survey of over 10,000 people actually completed this survey, and 14,560 started it, which is about a 65% completion rate, which is excellent for survey research, especially online research.
Mm-hmm. I think Ooh. All three of us here completed the survey.
Yeah.
Yep.
I remember when I was taking the survey, I was really worried that I was the only one taking it, and that people might.
I know him.
And you put on there. This is not Marshall. At last.
Well, who do I know that lives in Gardner, Kansas?
It made this whole thing to the most perverted level.
I just had this vision of you saying. Do I know any furries in Gardner, Kansas? I'm kidding. I don't live in Gardner. So, I do, actually. So, anyway, I took it, and apparently 10,000 other people completed it, which is amazing.
It was. It was shocking to us.
And basically, it was a survey of people who had left religion and who were willing to talk about the effects that that decision had upon their sex life.
Right.
And the guilt that they may or may not have felt while having sex.
And nobody in the history of the world, as far as I can find, has ever asked this question, has ever asked people about this. So that's the uniqueness of this research and why it's just gone viral on us. We have been shocked. Amanda and I have been shocked. It got picked up with the Daily Mail, which has 2 million readers, or over 2 million readers. Mm-hmm. And that was like 2 days after it came out. Well, after the Daily Mail in England, with 2 million readers, picks it up, then everybody and their dog picks it up. Los Angeles Times, New York Post, it was just everywhere.
So
South Africa.
Some dogs
Poland.
Took this survey too?
Well.
Oh.
Dogs were excluded.
Okay.
It was a race-specific survey. Or species-specific.
We're species here.
So, you know, one thing I wondered about it, and maybe you can address this, is, now, it was a voluntary survey.
Oh, you didn't make anybody do it, did you? He paid me.
I'm assuming it was voluntary. It was self-reports by self-confessed non-believers who were willing to discuss their sex life via a online survey. Do you think that would produce fairly accurate results for non-believers in sex in general?
Well, it's always a problem in survey research because you can't force people to take it. Mm-hmm. Even so-called randomized surveys, let's say, you know, like political surveys, just because they say it's randomized does not mean it truly is randomized, because imagine a surveyor calls you up and you don't want to talk to him, you just hang it up. Mm-hmm. Well, you don't know if that's creating, there's a bias there or not. So there's actually no such thing in terms of survey research of a truly randomized, number one. Number two, there's almost no such thing as a randomized sex survey. I mean, because can you imagine if we started trying to interview Baptists or Catholics on this stuff? Some of the questions in this survey, they would hang the phone up on you instantly or shut the computer off because it would contaminate their computer. I mean, we're asking questions that no Baptist or Catholic should be answering.
It'll only be coming from Satan.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Say, even though it's an anonymous survey, there's still that idea of like somebody, like you said, somebody might know it's me, and so they might answer, so they might, even if they answer the question.
Well, God is watching you anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Right. We're all going to know. Right.
So here's the thing: we were very concerned that our sample was somehow skewed, and not representative of the greater population of the United States. So what we did was if you read the survey, and I would encourage people to get online right now while they're listening and download it at ipcpress.com. It's a free download. Download it and read it, and then listen to this podcast.
Or you can read it while you're listening to the podcast.
Right. There you go. Well, we knew this would be a challenge to the research, which is a legitimate question. The question you're asking is legitimate. Mm-hmm. So what we did is we looked at the ARIS survey, was one of the largest sex and largest religious surveys in the United States. We looked at the Pew Memorial Trust survey, and we looked at the abstinence-only research. $500 million of your tax money has gone into the abstinence-only research. And we contrasted our results against all three of those huge mega-million, mega-thousands of people, and our research is almost identical to theirs.
Wow.
There's not a lick of difference. There's not a nickel's worth of difference between what our research says and what their research says. Mm-hmm. That is very important because it tells us that no matter who these people were, yes, they're all self-identified secularists now, but when they were religious, we can pretty well trust what they were saying is the same thing a currently religious Baptist is saying or a current religious Catholic might be saying. And that's the beauty of this research. I think it's nobody's been able to do this before or even thought of doing it.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing I noticed as well, and this really isn't indicative of anything because it's pretty much representative of the non-believer population in general, but I noticed that there were a lot more males participating in the survey than females, which, considering the fact that there are more males who are non-believers than females, is to be expected.
Well, it was 70-30. 70%, 30%, and that's pretty much true across the United States. If you look at the ARIS survey on religiosity in the United States, you get about a 70-30 split. Mm-hmm. And that's a randomized national survey that's done about every 5 years. So it's still consistent with this.
Yeah.
And there's probably reasons why women are more religious than men are. I mean, we can go into that, but that's not related to the survey, actually. But yeah, there's a bias there towards men, no doubt.
Yeah. I think if there's any one thing that truly shocked me about the survey, or that I found absolutely fascinating about the survey, and let me know if you guys agree, is the relative lack of disparity between theistic sexual behavior, the sexual behavior of people while they're believing in God, versus their sexual behavior while they're not. It's almost identical. Mm. And it really kind of contradicts this notion that Christian values, and the majority of the people were former Christians, if I remember correctly, are the key to a healthy, appropriate sex life. I mean, it clearly has almost no effect whatsoever.
No effect. None whatsoever.
That was actually one of the few things that didn't surprise me.
Me too.
I just kind of always figured that was the case, that it was the thing that you talked to, that you... It's kind of like pregnancy in the 50s. It happened all the time to unwed women. You just didn't talk about it. That's the reason why it was kind of swept under the rug. So I always kind of figured that with religious people, too, just from personal experience and growing up around a lot of religious people who constantly did the, you know, growing up in high school with the purity rings and things like that. Yeah. But they weren't pure.
And maybe it's ridiculous that I found that surprising, but there, especially by the time they reach the age of 21, there is statistically almost no difference.
No difference
whatsoever. They're at the previous age group, I forgot what age that was.
18.
You see a slight
8-10%
difference between sexual activity among theist and non-theist. But really, after that, no difference whatsoever.
No.
And
that's almost exactly the same results as the abstinence-only research has shown. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of, you know, abstinence-only seems to slow people down by 3 to 5 months before they start screwing somebody. And the problem is, though, when they start screwing somebody, they're not using condoms.
Right.
Yeah. But atheists or secularists have been well educated, and when they start, they're much safer. The highest STD rate, the highest teenage pregnancy, is among the most religious groups in the nation. And as we've seen just this week, our lovely Governor Rick Perry says abstinence only works, even though teenage pregnancies and STDs have gone up and up and up over the
right,
last
ever,
four or
ever
five years.
Since we started endorsing the abstinence only education.
Absolutely. Right.
Yeah.
It's a total policy failure.
Which, yeah, I don't even get started on that.
Yeah,
that
let's not go there.
It makes me so mad. I just, my blood's
take another on. Drink and don't go there.
No, drink it all. Another thing that initially surprised me, but after reflecting on it, doesn't surprise me as much, is that Catholics weren't as high on the guilt scale, or they weren't as prone to feel guilty about sex as a number of other Protestant denominations.
I think what we got there was cultural Catholics.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
yeah,
that
right.
could be true.
I think we had a lot of Catholics that were so-called cultural. When you think about it, most Catholics are using birth control.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
A heck of a lot of Catholics have had abortions. A lot of Catholics are getting divorces. Over 70% of all the annulments given in the entire world right now are given to the 3% of Catholics that live in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
70% of
oh,
all
yes.
the annulments are given to 3%
yeah.
of the people.
You know where I learned that, by the way?
The my God book. Yeah, so there's something going on there, and it says that Catholics are pretty much ignoring the Pope. Where's the lowest birth rate in the whole all of Europe?
Italy,
yeah, because mm-hmm. the Pope isn't having too much effect there.
No.
I think we got a lot of culture. I think Catholics are basically moving away from their own religion. They're
yeah.
not. They like the ritual. They attend church. They still get the guilt crap, but it's not nearly as bad as the top four. I mean, you notice the top four. And I thought that this was a surprise to us, too. Number one, I did not guess this. I would not have guessed this. I would have guessed Catholic.
Yeah.
And this was goes into the whole idea of what is surprising about this research. Number one in sexual guilt is Mormons.
That doesn't surprise me, to be honest with you. I would pick them behind Catholics, but they're pretty repressed.
Mm-hmm.
They are. You're right. Mormons are repressed. But Catholics are pretty far down compared to... I mean, Pentecostals, Jehovah's Witnesses, Seventh-day Adventists.
I'm surprised by Pentecostals because there's a lot of inbreeding going on in that particular generation.
Well, and that's the people that took the survey, too. I mean, I guess, I mean, you'd have to look at a lot of people didn't take the survey that might be or might not be.
Well, these are all X, whatever,
yeah,
ex-Pentecostals,
right,
ex-Catholics,
right,
and whatever.
Right.
You have probably haven't listened, I don't know if you or your listeners have listened to our Recovering From Religion has an official podcast now,
yeah.
and it's called Living After Faith. Well, Rich Lyons is doing this great podcast for us. I really love Rich and what he and his wife are doing, Deanna Joy. But one of the early podcasts, he was a Pentecostal minister for 20 years. And they had sex. He and his wife had sex about 12 times in 20 years. And you got to listen to this podcast. It's one of the earlier ones in his series. It's called Too Fucked Up to Fuck. It is hilarious, but it's also very serious.
Yeah.
And Pentecostal are uptight. And he talks about being the minister of this church and having almost every male come to him to talk, say, my wife doesn't want to have sex anymore. What do I do? And in the meantime, Rich is thinking, well, I haven't had sex but 12 times in my whole 20 years of marriage. What am I supposed to tell you?
Yeah.
Wow. And that's a pretty uptight group of people.
But, you know, you see the same thing in the Catholic Church, where you have men going to priests, many of who have never had sex.
Yeah, oh yeah.
With anyone but themselves.
Yeah, right.
But,
supposedly.
Yeah, supposedly. Asking for advice about sex as well.
Oh, yeah.
So, anyway, although I have noticed, when I was still a young Catholic, or before that, even... things have changed in the Catholic Church. They used to really talk about masturbation a lot. I remember that in my life. That's almost gone completely. They don't even talk about it. When I was in the seminary, they used to put seminarians... Well, not, before I was in the seminary, I heard tales of them putting seminarians on probation because they were masturbators. which only meant that they were the ones who got caught masturbating.
Oh, I thought they were debating.
Well, that would be master debaters.
Oh, okay, I got you.
But no, seriously, they really did. And it used to be a major, major hang-up with the Catholic Church that even though every single priest did it, they still had to maintain the facade of being disgusted by it, and maybe they were even disgusted by it.
Well, yeah, because God told them they shouldn't be.
Yeah, and it was totally hypocritical. That, for whatever reason, I think mainly because they knew that the public just won't tolerate just this absurd overemphasis of the evils of masturbation.
Yeah.
They just don't talk about it anymore.
Yeah.
Although technically, you masturbate once, you die, you spend the rest of eternity in hell.
When I was in clinical work as a psychologist, I had two different priests come to me, and both of them had problems with. They said that they needed some help. One had a pornography addiction, the other had a masturbation addiction, he said. And after several weeks of working with these two priests, I couldn't find anything wrong with them. They just seemed to be pretty normal human beings with no sexual outlet. As a result, of course, they didn't come back. Once I said, I can't help you because you need to go talk to the Pope about this.
Yeah.
And come back.
Well, sadly the Pope is too busy shielding pedophiles right now.
Yeah, right.
That,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, I'm interested in what you guys have to say about it. Well, you've read the survey, and I've sat here and talked all day about it. But
well, I enjoyed taking it, and I enjoyed a lot of the questions, but I found it difficult for myself. I was never very religious also.
Right.
I did have some. And so much of it didn't pertain to me. It was sort of difficult to answer the question because it was such a short-lived thing for me. I think you did a great, very thorough job of asking many questions to obtain all this information.
I bet you've never been asked some of those
questions.
No.
Yeah. I tell you what, the longer it went on, the more it was like, whoa, okay. It's not that I hadn't thought about it or done it or whatever. It's like, I mean, how many surveys have you ever seen that?
Oh, nothing like that.
That in depth. I mean, it's not. It's excellent.
I was going to say, I had kind of the same issue because I wasn't necessarily very religious growing up either, but that's not to say that religion didn't affect my sexual development.
Right.
Because there were definitely portions of, like, when I was 14 and 15, I did have the idea that I'm not going to sleep with anybody unless I'm engaged to them. So at least I didn't go to the married step, but I was the engaged. And that was definitely influenced by friends and family members who were religious and thought that was important for me too. So I kind of got that in my head of that's what a good person does.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of went through that too for a while. I wouldn't do it with anybody unless they were engaged.
You are a pervert. I always suspected that of you.
Well, I always liked the older women when I was younger. So, and I don't recall ever having any guilt about any sexual.
If
it felt good, I said,
I did.
Hell with
it. I had all sorts.
Even,
of
nothing. Yeah, I was gonna say, even though I had those convictions, that I just kind of, as I got older, just kind of started being like, that's not very realistic, and you know, and so I just didn't feel too bad about anything that I did because I was like, well, I think personally I made good decisions, so I didn't endanger my health or any of that kind of thing. So I was like, well, as long as I'm happy and not hurting anybody else, then it's got to be okay, you know. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, by the time I was 8, I had those same feelings.
But you know, I was the opposite. I felt, even though I wasn't sexually active until after I left the seminary.
Was that with people or yourself?
Not, I wasn't sexually active with anyone other than myself.
Wasn't sheep, was it?
I really just, I was just so disturbed and guilty by the, you know, just convinced I was some sort of weird freak that I had these sexual desires. And, you know, that there were times in my life that really haunted me, and I've mentioned it before, but I would just go what now seems absurdly long lengths of time literal abstinence, and then, you know, just get to the point where that's all I can think about.
Yeah, right.
You know?
The hormones are there whether you ignore them or not.
And that's why I call some sexual activity, regardless of the form, a biological imperative.
Yes.
For men, I think it's different for, it's subdued for women, to an extent. But for men, I mean, there's just not ever having an orgasm your entire life is not an option.
No, no.
It's just, right. And it's an absurd requirement for the priesthood in the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so. I think that depends. That depends for women. I do think that there are a lot of things that I think most of it is religious based that has kind of put into a lot of women's minds this idea that we're not supposed to. I think it's changing a lot, but you know, we're not supposed to enjoy sex. We're not supposed to go out and have multiple partners, because if we do, that means we're a slut or a hoe or something like that. And if a guy does that, well, that they're just studly. That's just what boys do. But good girls aren't supposed to do that kind of thing. So, I mean, I do think that there's like, because I don't necessarily think women don't need sexual stimulation as much as men. I just think it's something that you're just kind of taught to kind of repress about yourself.
Well, but
I think there's a huge difference between the cultural and the biological.
Yes.
And women are just as sexual as men are, and maybe more so, but our culture represses that, and many cultures do. It's not just one. But there are some cultures, and I'm working on really researching this pretty in depth right now in my new book. There are some cultures where women appear to have higher sex drives than men do. And men actually complain. There are cultures where men complain, my girlfriend, my wife, my lover, whatever, wants too much sex.
Oh, those sissies.
What cultures are those? Could you spell that? Moving, so.
Well, that would be an interesting thing, because that was the one thing that kind of interested me was actually the portion on the fantasy life and how it says the huge difference between women's fantasizing and men fantasizing. I don't know if that's maybe how the question was asked, that maybe, because it just seems like really weird to me that it's like, what is it, only 27% of women fantasize daily?
Right.
And then 76 is a little bit higher for weekly, but daily, I mean, you know, maybe it's just me. Maybe my libido is more active than other women, but yeah, I mean, daily, you know, it was interesting because we were actually at a meetup and somebody said something about, oh, well, some women can bring themselves to orgasm by just reading a book or something.
Yeah,
and one of the girls said, was kind of like looking puzzled, and I was like, really, you can't, because I can totally do that. You know, it's like, it's not that hard. I was like, you just kind of have to focus. And then she kind of said something that kind of made me go, oh, which was, well, what's the point? And I'm like, well, why not? If it's pleasurable, you enjoy it. But, you know, why wouldn't you?
What's
the
point in eating chocolate? Yeah. I mean,
right.
That would make going to the library.
And I'm even one of those women who's not necessarily into pornography. I don't even, you know, it's not even pornography that I can read, that I can, like, you know.
Well, that'd be coming pretty handy for going to work in the morning. Or not handy.
Not handy.
All right. Okay. That is interesting, actually. I know
that. You didn't know that, huh?
I'm buying the wrong books.
You're reading the wrong books.
Well, we did find a difference. There's no doubt about that, between male fantasy life and female fantasy life. And I think a part of that is probably biological. But I think a part of it may also be cultural. I think the culture does tell women it's inappropriate to fantasize in certain ways.
Right.
But I know, and we saw women, we gave plenty of opportunity for people to write responses in the survey. It wasn't just on a scale of 1 to 10,
right,
although we did a lot of scale of 1 to 10.
Mm-hmm.
After you did the 1 to 10, you could answer the question as much as you want. We got 4,000 responses from people. And of those 4,000, some were pages long. It was we were just blown away. Some people wanted to tell us their entire life story.
Did they send you any video?
I wish. Some of the stories were really interesting. I mean, I learned new words in this absolutely learned new words in this research. So it was very enlightening in many ways. Yeah. So anyway, we did find a difference between the men and women. I know that sometimes women fantasize in such a different way than men do.
Right, which is why I said maybe it was just maybe not the right kind of questions or something like that. Or even women, you know, I don't know how many of these women maybe had children, maybe they just didn't fantasize and they didn't have time, you know, no time to think about that. So, you know, that could
Johnny,
be...
Johnny, shut up. Mommy's about to get off.
Our sample was...
You gotta make the time.
Our sample was very young. Over 65% of our sample is under 30 years of age.
Okay.
And a fairly large percentage were still single, and a very large percentage were in college or in graduate school. So it's a skewed sample. There's no doubt about that. We're not trying to bullshit anybody, but it's to the young and to the male. But of the females, it was skewed even younger. There was lots of young women who took our survey of the 30% or so that were female. But yeah, it's fascinating stuff.
You know, one thing that didn't surprise me is that theists watch more porn than non-theists. And I think that a large percentage of that, or a large factor in that, is because they have to keep that secret, you know, because of their desire to maintain a standing in the religious community and things like that. Whereas non-theists is really not an issue. You know?
Hey, what I just gave my talk 2 days ago. I was down in Springfield on Sunday, and I gave my talk about the survey. And I asked, I literally said, how many of you use pornography? And 2/3 of the people raised their hand. I said, how many of you masturbate? And 3/4 of the people raised their hand.
The rest of you are liars.
The rest of them are liars. Right. You couldn't ask that question in a Baptist church.
Right.
But they are anyway.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, to your listeners, think about it. Where is the highest use of porn in the United States?
With the religious.
Utah.
And number two is Mississippi. Utah and Mississippi are the number one and number two users of pornography in the entire
world. Well,
and that's been true for over 10 years. Mm-hmm. And we know this because you can track this stuff on the internet.
Right.
And I wonder if that has to do also with a little bit of it just being taboo. Not even so much that they're watching it because they're like, ooh, I'm going to watch some porn and get off, but they're actually doing it because they're like, I'm not supposed to be doing this.
Oh, they're watching it a lot.
It's
paid subscription.
Oh, okay.
There's a great book. It came out about 2 or 3 months ago called A Billion Wicked Thoughts. I would recommend it. It's really one of the better books I've read, although there's two others I would recommend more. A Billion Wicked Thoughts. And it's these two people, and I have intentionally not found out if they're male or female. Their names are names I can't recognize, male or female. So I told myself, I'm going to read this book, and I'm not quite finished. I'm going to read this book, and I'm not going to find out, because I want to see if there's any bias. I cannot find any bias in this book. It is really well written. But what they're doing is they're looking at billions of internet searches and billions of subscriptions to porn sites and stuff like that. So now what we're really finding through this book and others is, what is the human brain really looking for, male and female? It's a fascinating study. I would really recommend it. A Billion Wicked Thoughts.
So you can't really tell whether it's written by men, women.
Or women. Yeah, or it could be a man and a wife, right. Or a man and a woman. I don't know.
A billion
wicked thoughts.
That's a long book.
Well, it's... Yes.
I don't think they review every week.
Oh, okay. They just tell you there's a billion. Okay, I got you.
But they can tell you what the top 10 search terms are for gay males.
Huh.
Yeah, so that's it. Or what are the top 10 search terms of Christian women?
Oh, wow. How would they know?
Oh, because what they find is things like 40% of all women who visit one of the most popular Christian websites also visit porn sites.
So they know what to expect.
I mean, this is crazy stuff. But in our research, we found the same thing. We found that religious people are using porn even more than secular people are, by about 10.
Well, I don't think we should stand for that. We should start watching more.
We need to ramp it up, people. What the heck's wrong with us?
Yeah, we can't let them outdo us.
Religious are kicking our ass.
You know, the questions we asked a lot of questions around all sorts of stuff, but porn we really focused on. I think we had 4 or 5 different questions around pornography. And Amanda Brown, my co-author on the study and research, she really helped refine these questions. But it was interesting because she was surprised by the response. She has a certain attitude about pornography. And needless to say, it's very, very liberal. But the porn she likes was very different from the porn that the women in our survey like. She has more a male pattern, porn pattern, than most females do. And that surprised her. Now, she and I did a podcast a couple weeks ago together, and she was talking about on the podcast about how she was surprised. She didn't realize that her own preferences for porn were more like men. I guess.
Well, you know, I've dated quite a few women in my past that were like that, that had more of the taste of enjoyed reading the same type of magazines.
Yeah. This is all very fascinating because, I mean, obviously I've never watched porn.
Yeah.
Ever.
Bless you, my child.
I guess,
you're going to go straight to purgatory.
What are those icons on that?
And I'm disgusted by anyone who does. But, no, I'm kidding. I have, I'll admit, I have watched porn in my life.
Twice. Both times, huh?
Yeah. I have a wife who fortunately never listens to my podcast.
Until now.
Actually, that is kind of funny because my boyfriend, when I was in high school, had a subscription to Playboy, and I think I read them more than he did. Of course, I was reading them more for the articles because
Playboy has awesome articles. We always hear that.
And the jokes and the advice columns and all that stuff, but he I think he would like flip through them once and then just toss them aside. And I was like, why do you even get the subscription?
Well, it's flip to the middle, turn it sideways, and then put it away.
Well, 5 minutes later, you put it away.
That's not very long.
Well, maybe 10 minutes for you.
Congratulations.
Speaking of Playboy, this is so cool. After the sex survey came out, Playboy magazine got a hold of it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and they heard that I'm writing a new book. My new book's going to be called Sex and God, and I got it from one of the editors. I don't know which one. One of the editors emailed me and said, let us know as soon as the galleys are ready for the new book.
Good.
So Playboy magazine's interested in the new book. Well, cool. Of course, I don't know if they'll review it or not, but wouldn't that be cool?
Maybe if you could put a sample chapter in or something.
If there's anything else out there like this, I mean.
No, there's nothing has ever been done like this.
You're going to get a lot of
new
stuff.
And the book, there's nothing ever been done like the book either. I've really looked hard to find it. I can't find anybody writing this.
This might be your shot for fame, man.
I've always been a pervert.
Is that how you signed it? No, Ray, the pervert.
The pervert.
Yes. How do you like your sex? I'm doing a survey.
Let me open my coat and show you.
No, I'm not into that.
No. But
you got us off on porn, and we haven't even discussed anything.
That's what happens with sex.
I think we should eat more cheese balls because that's a fascinating, although understandable, hypocrisy among the religious community. It's the things that they condemn the most are the things that they seem to engage in the most.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and it's just absolutely bizarre to me that the sexually pious Christian usually is the biggest hypocrite you'll ever meet.
Right.
And
the only difference we could find in our research between religious people and secular non-religious people was guilt. The behavior's different.
Yeah, that's what I wanted
to say. The guilt is different. That the religious people are very guilty about masturbating and having premarital sex or whatever else they're told they're not supposed to do, anal sex with their wife or whatever, her husband. But they're guilty about it afterwards, whereas the secular people aren't.
Well, and
they just have fun.
And that's the question I had forgotten. Guilt is an aspect of all of this, is really what you geared the survey about.
When I wrote the God Virus, I have a whole area, chapter in the book around the guilt cycle. Mm-hmm. It's maybe some area we should explore a little bit with their listeners, of course. But I kept getting comments and questions from people after I wrote the book. Do you have any proof for this guilt cycle thing? And I realized, nobody's ever asked the question. There's not been any scientific research on the guilt cycle. So I figured maybe that's a good thing to do. I have no doubt it works because I've seen it happen so many times when I was back in clinical practice as a psychologist. So Amanda and I structured the questions to try and elicit, to try and understand what's happening with sex. Now, let me explain the guilt cycle, because it's very key to understanding religion, I think. And that is, religion has to teach you what to be guilty of. Mm-hmm. So Muslims are going to teach you to be guilty around eating pork. And Mormons are going to teach you to feel guilty around drinking caffeine or alcohol. And Catholics are going to teach you to feel guilty around masturbation or eating meat on Friday or whatever. But every religion has what I call its own guilt pattern. Mm-hmm. So once you've been indoctrinated into that specific religion's guilt pattern, the only place you can get forgiveness is back at that particular religion's back at that particular religion. You never hear of Muslims going and confessing their sins to a priest, a Catholic priest. Mm-hmm. And you never hear of Catholics going and confessing their sins to a Baptist. They always come and confess their sins or read their Bible or go to Bible study or go to church or go to Sunday school to get rid of their sins and their guilt at the place they learned the guilt in the first place. So it's like religion teaches you the disease, gives you the disease, and then says, oh, we can give you a fake cure too. Come back to us and we can... So you feel guilty about masturbating, you have to come back to the Catholic priest to give, you know, to confess. Mm-hmm. Right. You can't go to the Baptist church to get forgiveness. You have to go to the priest or the imam or, you know, whatever it is. That's the way the guilt cycle works. And that's what we're really looking for. Where's the evidence for the guilt cycle? And we found tons of evidence for the guilt cycle in this survey.
Because ultimately what you found is while the behaviors are identical among religious and non-religious, the guilt is what really is the difference.
Only difference we can find.
The only difference, the only significant difference is the guilt. And I think you even found, and this actually surprised me, is there, among the participants of the survey, there wasn't this residual effect that once they freed themselves from the chains of religion, the guilt was gone.
Yeah, that shocked us.
Yeah.
We had six hypotheses we were testing. And the sixth one was that there is residual guilt after you leave religion.
But there isn't.
We fully expected to see that, and that shocked us. We can find very, very little evidence about that. Hmm. That's not to say there aren't some people that still have residual guilt or have problems, maybe as a result of the programming around their sexuality.
Sure.
But we can find nothing. It was really mind-boggling. We thought there'd be a hell of a lot more than there.
Yeah, that is really interesting because, you know, that is something that is so ingrained in you. And it's not just, like I said, for me, it wasn't even a religious thing necessarily.
Right.
It was a cultural thing.
Right.
And in so many ways, religion has influenced culture to think a certain way about sex and sexuality.
Right.
So even if you don't participate in a religion, you still have some of those cultural norms that you kind of have to fight against sometimes, maybe even to feel comfortable about sex. So it's interesting to me that it's not necessarily too surprising that people let go of the guilt, but it's surprising how quickly they let go of the guilt.
That was what surprised us. It seems to be like not years but months.
Right.
I can say that's true from my anecdotally from my own personal experience.
Oh really?
It was just like I don't believe that shit anymore. I don't feel guilty. You know.
Well, you know, people lose a lot of shit after they leave religion.
Mm-hmm.
Sex is one part of it.
Right.
But they seemed, and I know, Cole, you've seen this even more than I, with your work and in all the different groups you lead, how quickly people seem to, you know, be liberated.
Right.
I mean, it's almost like they're liberated.
They're almost all of them say it came on to them real quick, just like you said.
Yeah.
And they usually hang around for a while, read some books, and then they find a group or find something, some other avenue that's social.
Yeah.
And when they come in, it's almost... never slow.
Yeah,
it doesn't take like, although I, you know, there was one person I think once it was like several years, but that's rare.
Oh.
It's quick.
It was a gradual process for me in that it was just a process of elimination where I just point by point eliminated that as a possibility. You know, the Eucharist, that's just stupid. Why would anyone
do that? Here, have a cracker.
Confession. And then when I finally realized, I don't believe anything anymore. Then I said, hey, I'm not. Why am I still calling myself a Christian?
Well, you know? I'm with you. It was a slow process for me. It probably took between 8 and 10 years.
Wow.
For me to get there. Now, by the time I was 40, I was pretty much there. But I could say at the end of my seminary work, after 2 years, I was 26 years old when I graduated from seminary. I wouldn't call myself an atheist or agnostic even. I was probably more like a deist.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
It took another 14 years before
I
could openly, Well, no, I never opened. I didn't call myself. I remember on a backpacking trip with some semi-religious friends of mine, and they asked me what I was, and I said, well, I'm an active agnostic. I just couldn't say the word. Mm-hmm. And this was 10 years ago.
Of course, this is the agnostic salvation hour.
Well, I know, and I'm happy to be on the agnostic salvation in this case, the agnostic salvation hour.
Well, not saying about Marshall, he includes atheists, too.
Yes. Yeah,
I think by the current definitions of the word, easily fit within the definition of atheist and agnostic. I don't even know what the difference is, being honest with you.
Yeah,
I think what happens is the word agnostic gets abused by theists who still want to believe in God but don't want to call themselves Christians.
Or those who are really atheists but aren't comfortable with actually saying it.
For a lot of woo.
Well, coming out is pretty mm-hmm. stressful and dangerous in some circles.
Yeah, so that's why I introduced myself as Marshall instead of getting my last name, because I don't really care, but... You know, if I ever lose my job...
No one knows his last name?
I don't even know my last name.
How much money got on
Smith. You didn't know his last name was Smith.
But, you know, if I ever lose my job and I got to find another job, I'm just a... You know, if you put your last name out there, you're a Google search away from... Oh, he doesn't believe it.
Unemployment line.
Yeah. So, I have to... And that's really it. I mean, because I have people who know that I don't believe in God, but... I'm just really hesitant about putting it out there, you know, because I'm scared. But anyway, that's not really enough.
Well, so you're not just don't believe in God, but you're also a pervert. We found that out from your...
Yeah, that's another reason I want to keep my last name hidden. Because I love the furries. I'm so kidding about that. I'm a pervert in some areas. I own several cats, and I do not find them attractive at all.
Kitty.
I can see Marshall now late at night.
Peanut butter is for sandwiches.
Well, if your listeners are watching, I think page 16 is...
How can
really,
they watch? This is
well,
report.
Listening, okay. I'm sorry. Watching the report, because they've downloaded it at IPCPress.com, and they're reading along as we're being drunkenly guided by Marshall here. I regret having offered him the wine. But on page 16,
this is one of our most fun nights. We've always talked about drinking and doing a podcast.
Yeah, I was talking about that for a year and a half. Where we all got
drinking
drunk.
Liberally.
Oh, yeah. We need this on a Friday night.
So anyway, on page 16, we talk about the four different aspects of sexual introduction to sex, and that is masturbation and petting and oral sex and intercourse. And we looked at three different age groups, 15, 18, and 21. And you kind of alluded to this earlier, Marshall, about the difference. But we could find almost no difference between those raised most religious and those raised mm-hmm. least religious in any of those four areas, except at age 18, mm-hmm. which there's about an 8 to 10% difference between the two. But by 21, they're all caught up. Well, the abstinence-only research shows exactly the same thing, mm-hmm. which really validates the stuff we're seeing here.
Right.
We have... You know, for a few hundred dollars, we did this survey, and $500 million was done to find out abstinence only doesn't work.
Yeah.
Well, that's a pretty big waste of your tax dollars. I'm thinking, federal government, next time you need an answer, call me. I'll charge you $250 million.
How did you get it to, what'd you do? Just call people from different groups? Or, I mean, how did you do this massive mail out?
I didn't mail it out. Amanda and I bought an account on SurveyMonkey.com. We put, which is a very sophisticated survey research kind of a website. We put our stuff together and tested it out. We tested it with 21 experts and refined some questions and modified them. And then we put it up on the web and we told several major bloggers like Greta Christina,
mm-hmm.
and eventually we told PZ Myers, and we told
Matt Dillahunty.
I mean, we told about a dozen different bloggers, and they were kind enough to put it up on their websites or on their blogs. And lo and behold, I mean, just overnight, the first night we were hoping to get 200 or 300 people, and the real story was we're going to test it on 200 or 300 people before we went live.
Mm-hmm.
So we put it up on a Monday night, And I wake up the next morning, I check, and I'm looking for maybe, hoping I've got 100 or 200, because maybe by the end of the week we'll have 300, and that's enough to really go to... I wake up the next morning, we have 2,500 people taking this wow. thing. I'm thinking, oh, crap.
Wow.
We can't stop it.
Yeah.
And we knew there was still some problems with it. I mean, for example, you said the main problem was a lot of atheists said, well, these aren't questions relevant to me because I've never been religious. Well, what blew our minds was how many, almost 40% of the people that filled this out, somewhere around 35 to 40%, were never religious to begin with.
Really?
Yeah, that we much. Never thought of that. I mean, seriously.
30 to 40% of
we
the people.
We screwed wow. up on that part of it. Yeah, because we wow. would have modified the questions to be more
right, sure.
atheist friendly if we'd have known that. So your complaint is perfectly legitimate.
Right.
But the fact is, we woke up the next morning thinking, "Oh, we got 300 people. We'll modify it. We'll take it down. We'll modify it, and then we'll put it back up." Well, you can't stop it when you got 2,500
right,
people,
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
and probably another right. 2,500 filling it right. out as we speak.
Sure.
So, are you going to address that in your book?
Well, that's a whole other question.
Okay,
I'll
okay,
come back to
right,
that.
Right.
So what happened was we said, okay, we'll just leave it up. And a couple days later, Amanda calls me up and says, have you let PZ Myers know about this? I said, no, because we were just testing it. I wasn't ready to release it.
Right.
She said, well, since we're not stopping it, let's let PZ know. So I sent an email to PZ, and she sent an email to PZ, her husband did. And the next morning I wake up, and there's another 4,000 overnight just from PZ. PZ, out of 14,500 people that took this sucker, about half of them came from PZ Myers' like blog
wow.
alone. Now, that's not to say that the others... I mean, Atheist Nexus probably is responsible for 2,000, and Atheist Resource maybe another 1,000 or so, but, you know, PZ beats them all.
Oh,
it's amazing how much his blog
oh,
is.
Oh, yeah.
Team so, PZ.
Yeah, you got it. I'm Team PZ. So that's how we got it out. We just... PZ, oh, it's really funny. I sent it to PZ, and the next morning I wake up and I look, and it's gone from like 6,000 to 10,000 overnight. Well, we got a virus or something. Something's
oh,
wrong
shit.
Here. Yeah, no, something's wrong. And then I realize, oh, well, let me look. And I look at PZ, and Human Meta helped us too. I look at PZ, and he had put it up there. He said, and here's what he said. He said, some perverts want to know about your sex life. And he said, I took it last night, and I found out my sex life is pretty vanilla or something like that.
See, you know, he knew how to help you out.
Pretty boring.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
that's all he
yeah,
said.
Yeah.
And
oh, that's
geez,
pretty good,
overnight
though.
Overnight it went up.
That
yeah,
get
so we owe a big thanks to Atheist Nexus and PZ
right.
Myers and Matt Dillahunty. I mean, you
Atheist
name it. We had an Atheist Experience. We had a lot of help.
Absolutely.
And that's fun. You know, it's the whole community coming together
right,
to
right.
learn
yeah.
something. As a result, I mean, you think about it, nobody's ever asked these questions. We know something about ourselves that nobody ever knew before. And it's because all these people are helping us.
I knew about you for a time, maybe.
All you
well,
me
that's because you were probably talking to Julie too much.
Yeah, yeah, she's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Don't believe anything she tells
oh, okay.
you. Some more ice, please.
You're gonna hear, the audience is about to hear some ice being poured into a cup.
That's okay. Into a cup, out of a cup.
So, anyway, what's next on the calendar for Dr. Darrell Ray?
Next is the book, and that's going to be called Sex and God, How Religion Distorts Sexuality. Now, I did this survey.
Tell me when.
That's fine, thanks. I did this survey as kind of preliminary research for the book. Mm-hmm. I had no idea what this sucker was going to do to me. We put it up in January, and I thought, oh, I'll have the book finished by May or June. Well, this stupid survey put my life on hold for 4 months. I'm serious. Almost every waking hour for 4 months, I was doing statistical analysis, or I was writing. Or
wow, no masturbating for you, huh?
Yeah, well, I worked one or two in here and there. Julie helped me, too.
Okay.
She's very generous in that area. Among other people that helped me, but just mainly Julie.
It wasn't me.
No. So I'm behind about 4 to 6 months on getting the book finished, but I'm glad we did it because this is gonna, you know, flow into a little bit of it. It's going to flow into the book. This really wasn't the main part of the book. The book is going to really focus on a lot of other issues. You know, how does religion affect and impact human sexuality? And I thought I knew a lot about this subject before I started writing this book. But dang, I didn't know diddly squat. It's amazing what I've learned just from.
Well, I think you were dead on about the guilt factor and the reason that religions focus on sexual behavior. All of them. I don't know if there are religion.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, all of them. It's because it's the hook.
Right.
People are going to have some sort of sexual behavior. If we tell them that they're evil for doing so and they have to receive forgiveness from us, we got them.
You got them.
And it's a brilliant scheme. I have to give the religious that. Right. I really do.
It's a brilliant scheme that was really invented with Judaism. Mm-hmm. And it was perfected in Christianity and Islam. Buddhism's perfected it, as has Baha'i and Mormonism. Don't let anybody tell you Buddhists aren't sexually uptight. They're very uptight.
I was going to say, that always bothers me when people say, oh, they're so liberal. Yeah. I'm like, no, they're not. No, they're not liberal at all.
No.
The American Buddhists, maybe.
Because it's a brushed up, shiny, different version of Buddhism that they practice
I think it's more of a FU to Christianity than anything else here in the United States.
Yeah, California Buddhism is anything but what Buddhism is practiced anywhere else in the world. So I don't even consider it. Yeah, so that's the next step. Is in January, the Sex and God, how religion distorts sexuality.
Well, you know, an amazing thing, and I don't know if you've considered this, is that the religions in the past that were tolerant of sexuality are gone. You know, the pagan religions, there's been a revival among the Wiccan community and other pagan communities, but for the most part, as a percentage of the population, they don't really exist.
No.
And maybe that's the reason, is because they did not have that obligation, that threat of damnation.
What you have, and to use Richard Dawkins' terminology, you have a meme that plugs into a biological imperative. Mm-hmm. So if you can create a meme that makes you feel guilty about something you're going to do anyway, it's a perfect feedback loop.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, when religion's hooked on that, I mean, and there was, Judaism figured it out first. Because before that, sex and religion went together, but they didn't necessarily go in a sex-negative way.
Right.
I mean, they may have been a sex-positive, sex-neutral. I mean, yeah, there's lots of religions that are sex-negative that aren't Christian, Muslim, or Judaism. But it didn't become systematically as well-defined and refined until Judaism came along. And, you know, you look at the Judaism of the day of Jesus, or, say, 200 to 300 years before, and it was pretty sexually repressive. In fact, you read the Bible and you read the Quran, and you can almost interchange those two in the way they treat women and the way they treat sexuality. There's no difference between the Old Testament and the Quran in the way they treat women and sexuality.
Yeah.
So those ancient patriarchal herder desert tribes were all acting the same, whether they were Jews or they were Arabs. They're all the same.
I think it was the heat. Maybe.
It may have been.
I think it was just because men decided women were property, and
in order
to keep them from doing what they didn't want them to do, not to say that religions didn't say men couldn't do those things either, but it just seems like, you know, when you're reading the Bible or the Quran or any of those, you know, men can have harems, and they can even sleep with the slave girls that they have and things like that. But if a woman, sleeps with one of the slave boys, well, that's just automatic death or whatever.
Well, heaven forbid he sleep.
Yeah.
He should sleep with a slave boy, too.
Well, yes. There was that, too, but...
That was Steve.
Yeah.
Steve's a rascal.
Well, you haven't heard much from you, Cole. What did you?
Well, I've been talking like crazy.
Well, I mean, now, in terms of the actual survey, anything that's jumped out at you that you found interesting?
No. The one thing in the very beginning, I said, because I wasn't very religious. I mean, I did have some religion in my life, but it was so little that it was difficult for me to take some of this. But we've already discussed that. Other than that, I don't think I've never seen anything. I've taken a lot of surveys, and I've had a lot of people send me things. You send it to me, and we got you probably 30 or 40 interviews, opposed to thousands. But I have had other surveys and other stuff sent to me. Nothing this massive. I mean, this is you know, so many questions.
We were actually worried about that.
No, I think
we had 69 questions.
I know. when you did this for the skeptics group, yeah. we were laughing about you. That was not intended. Right.
But that's a lot of questions. And online surveys, you know, if you can get people to spend 5 minutes,
sure.
That's
how long did do you guys remember what was it was about? I was going to say close to an hour.
30, 45 minutes. What, or
did
so.
It? Right. I took my time, and you know, of course, I take breaks, and so you know, for things, you know, to. And so I would say it took me close to an hour to take it, which is a lengthy, which is very lengthy. I mean,
yeah, it was a struggle for me because I don't like to go that long without masturbating.
Yeah, yeah. or at least thinking about it.
Your wife will not listen to this, right?
Of course, I wasn't joking about that.
Yeah, right. Okay,
yes,
whatever.
Sweetie, he was joking. Not.
But it was a long survey, and the fact that you got so many people to complete it. I mean, you had more people start it and not complete it, but
well, 65% completion rate is pretty darn good.
Yeah.
Any kind of survey research, especially online. You hope for 60%, and many surveys are satisfied with 50%.
Right.
So this is darn good.
So
80% of our respondents were from within the United States. 20% were outside the United States. So that was a big concern, is are these people going to skew our results? And we really looked at those. We drilled down to try and understand who those 20% were. And what we found was a lot of those people were American citizens living outside the United States.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Or they were English speakers, like in England, Australia, or Canada.
Sure.
Or they were people who had been in the United States going to school, or they were military people. I mean, I would say of the 20%, half of them were pretty much residents of the United States, but they're living somewhere else. And the other 10% were, you know, they're from England. We got enough people in this survey to do a sub-analysis. We haven't done it yet. We could do a sub-analysis from Canada, UK and Australia. That's how many we got. We could do a sub-analysis.
It would be interesting to have one from the military.
Well, we don't know.
Yeah.
We didn't ask. We don't know. We did get, if you look at the comments, we'll say, well, I'm living on an air base in Ramstein, Germany. Well, that tells you they're probably
As someone who was in the military, I can tell you those people are freaks.
Well, when I was writing for the Star, I got a response from one of the people to the Star from a lady that was an assistant to a chaplain. She was an atheist.
Oh, cool.
And she read my first or second article and wrote me this lengthy letter and kept in contact until she got back. And when she got back home, she goes, you're not going to hear from me much because I'm back home with my husband. Haven't heard from her since. So I guess they're doing their own survey, sex survey.
One-on-one.
We don't need to be.
One of the more interesting things, we asked, now that you are non-religious, how has your sex life changed? And we were able to slice and dice that in several different ways. Well, one of the ways we sliced and diced was what denomination were you versus how has your sex life changed? And we found similar results to the guilt part of it. Now that you're non-religious, how has your sex life changed? Number one group that said their sex life had improved on a scale of 1 to 10. And let's review this. A 1 means it went really south. It's really bad. Much worse than when I was religious. And a 10 means much, much better than when I was religious. And a 5, it hasn't changed. The Jehovah's Witnesses are number 1 in our survey. They said 8.2 on a scale of 1 to 10. So the best thing you can do, if you're listening to this right now, and you're a Jehovah's Witness, you have a lot of those on this.
Oh, yeah.
Get out of Jehovah's Witness because you're going to have such a great. You got orgies in your mouth.
And Cole Morgan.
Mormon, Seventh-day Adventist. I mean, pretty much the top four we saw in guilt also said they were the top four in improvement in sex.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Now, there was some variance. It's not just a cookie cutter from one to the other. So, we are asking these questions to see the data, not some projection of our own bias and opinions. So it was pretty interesting. Although those top four show up in the top five or six anyway. Children about sex. Well, that's not much. That's not very good. But then when you compare that to the highly religious parents, only 13%. Less than a third of religious parents are actually talking to their children. So that's very good evidence for the guilt cycle. The more I feel guilty about sex, the less I'm going to be able to talk about it to my partner or to my children. Atheists don't feel guilty about sex, or as guilty, they can talk to their children. And there's just good evidence here for the guilt cycle.
Well, I have some hypothesis about that. I think, one, the reason that religious parents won't talk to about their child is because in order to talk to them, they have to acknowledge that they know something about sex. They can't admit that.
Well, they had their kids.
Yeah, that's all they know.
Immaculate.
That's why my parents always joked. They're like, "We've only had sex 3 times for all you know."
And that's all I want to know.
I like your parents.
But in fairness, I like to think that about my mother. She only had sex once and somehow...
Miraculous.
Yeah, 3 children, 3 years apart. I don't know how it worked, but...
Well, one of the things I think is very... and I talk about this at the very end. I have this whole section on the... editorial comment. I separated from the scientific stuff. I think it's really important for us as secularists to think about. Preachers are standing up every Sunday and telling people, don't have sex before marriage, don't masturbate, you know, don't. I just want to ask a simple question to that minister. Do you masturbate? And did you have sex before marriage? And did you use condoms with your 2 girlfriends in Bible college that you didn't end up marrying? You know, what I am very convinced about is to be religious is to lead a lie. Because here's the way it works. Let's say I'm a minister and I'm standing up and preaching this bullshit. Yet I had sex before I was married. I have to tell my congregation, don't have sex before you're married, as if I didn't do it. Don't masturbate, as if I don't do it. It's a double standard. I know I did it and I'm lying. But religious parents have the same problem. If you're my child and you and I need to talk to you about sex, I can say, don't have sex before marriage. Mm-hmm. Well, you're going to ask me, well, Dad, did you have sex before marriage? I have 2 choices.
Lie.
I can lie or I can tell you the truth.
I just smacked the heck out of that kid.
How dare you dad, ask your father that kind of question?
You and my dad would have got along just fine.
So if I tell a lie, it makes life real simple. Mm-hmm. Marshall, your mother and I never had sex before we were married, and we've only had sex once, and that was when you were conceived. Yeah. Or I could tell the truth and said, yeah, I had sex. Now the problem is then I gotta start answering a bunch of questions. Like Marshall's probably gonna say, well, Dad, how many times did you have sex? And if I'm truthful, I'll say, oh, 50 or 60. And, oh, how many partners? Oh, 4 or 5. I mean, before you know, well, so it's good for you, but it's not good for me. It'll ruin your marriage if you have sex before. Well, did it ruin your marriage, Dad? Well, no. I mean, so you see all these ugly questions you got to answer if you're a Christian. So what I know, absolutely know this for a fact, most Christians are lying son of bitches because they are telling their children lies about how they actually behaved when they were adolescents. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important thing to get out
absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. Well, you know, another reason why they parents don't want to talk about it, and I know this for a fact because I've had these conversations with people, is if you talk about it, it's perceived as condoning sexual behavior.
And I think I'm not a parent, but you know I have nieces and nephews, and I think that that's a fear that parents have. But I think a lot of parents don't understand how much influence they really have over their children, and if you teach them important things about sex, to respect your body, to do you know to use protection, all these things, it's not necessarily like just because you talk about it they're going to run out and have sex. I think that's like a fear that a lot of parents have when they say, you know, let me know when you want to, if you think you even want to have sex, for a daughter, so we can put you on birth control, or let me know so we can go buy you condoms if you're a boy. You know, I mean, I don't think that that's necessarily condoning it. I think that's just saying, I don't want you to do this right now. You're too young. But if you're going to do this, we need to take steps to prevent bad things from happening.
It's treating and the children problem is,
like they're
people who can make their own decisions.
Right. It's learning that as a parent and as your child grows, they're going to become young adults and they're going to take on those responsibilities. And you have to be able to trust them to some extent. And if you don't, then you're going to run into problems. And I say that coming from a family that was fairly open about sex. My mom and dad were honest. They said, no, we didn't have, we weren't our first, you know, sexual partners. They even stressed, we don't want you to have sex right now as a 14, 15, 16 year old kid. But there again, if you're going to do this, please come to us. Please talk to us because, you know, they weren't stupid. They understood, you know, once we were in a serious relationship, you know, that thing is probably going to come up. And it's more important that you protect yourself and your health and your well-being than it is to, you know, go out and do something reckless. And even, I will say, even doing that, one of my sisters ended up pregnant because she didn't take the right precautions.
Right. Did your parents... Did they have an open relationship with them like that too? Did they ever
no,
say?
No, oh no. My
so there it was very close.
My grandmother, I think, over the years and being around us, because my grandmother has lived with us for a very long time, has actually kind of become more liberal and open, but sex is never something you'd want to talk about with the grandma. That's not the thing that would happen. And like my aunt and uncle are very, very conservative and would never talk about anything like that. But my parents were just very open and honest because they wanted us to understand the decisions that we were making, not only the physical consequences, but the emotional consequences.
Right, yeah.
Because I think that's something that is when you take away that education from kids, and I think that's important education that needs to be in there, not just the physical parts of sex, but also the mental parts of sex, because not everybody's the same. Some people are okay with having one night stands. Some people want to be in a loving relationship.
Right.
You know, there's various different things, and you need to understand. And that's why I think it's important for parents to talk about those kinds of relationships, because you have to learn that, yes, you can have sex with somebody else, love them, fall out of love with them, and fall in love with somebody else, and just because you've had sex with that other person doesn't mean that the sex you're going to have with the person that you fall in love with and maybe ultimately marry isn't going to be as good or as great or anything like that. I think too much emphasis is placed upon this whole idea, this whole notion of you can only have the one person.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so frustrating to me. You know, if I ever have children, I'm going to tell them, you, especially when they're young, you should wait until you're in a good relationship, whatever. But, you know, if you have sex with somebody, you know, I hope it's great, you know.
Enjoy it.
And I would be the, I would be the total mom that would gross my kid out and say, test drive the car before you buy it, man.
But, you know.
Because I just can't imagine committing to some sort of, to that much of a relationship, making that big of a commitment without knowing what that person's going to be like in every aspect.
Yeah. Wait, and, you know, I have known three Catholic women who, as far as I can tell, their parents, the conversation their parents had with them about sex was, you'll go to hell if you use a condom.
Jeez.
Because they got pregnant outside of wedlock, and I asked them, why didn't you use birth control? Because I'm a Catholic. It's like, okay, as a former Catholic myself, I was a Catholic at the time, I got news for you. Having sex outside of marriage is just as big as sex, if not worse.
Yeah.
But they didn't have it. They never had that conversation because they're going to have sex.
Right.
And I think that was
the other point I was going to make, too, with that, with the whole that, even with the secular kids, mm-hmm. that parents aren't really talking to their children about sex. And that is another big push, in my opinion, and big reason why we have to be teaching this in the schools. Because, obviously, parents are not doing their job
right.
in that respect. And if they're not doing their job, we have to, because it ceases being a moral issue and becomes a public health issue.
Yeah absolutely. You know, and everybody's affected by that.
Right.
And if there's an unwed child or if there's an STD, our tax dollars are going into that. So,
right.
So.
Well, this study shows this. I mean, you said 38% of the secular parents.
Of the secular parents.
That's small.
That's really small. Yeah.
That's good. I mean, it's good at doing it. You know, my parents weren't very religious, and I always found out most of what I knew from cousins or friends or something outside. Because I had already learned that asking questions or other things didn't work too well with them, so that wouldn't work either. So I just,
you know, the conversation I had with my mother, I swear I'm not making this up, is that I could go blind if I met I swear.
Well, you don't wear glasses.
Marshall, microphone's over here.
Like I said earlier, we let people write a lot of comments in the survey, and something you said triggered a thought. On page 36, we've a quote from one of the people. It says almost exactly what you just said, and I'm going to read it here. There was a large space of time between becoming, this woman is saying this, large space of time between becoming sexually active and becoming non-religious. During that time, I put myself at an unnecessary risk of disease and pregnancy. While I was religious, guilt kept me from taking basic precautions like birth control or condom use. To me, using any sort of contraceptive was tantamount to admitting that I was planning for and indeed desirous of sexual activities. Deciding not to use contraception allowed me to convince myself that my pleasure was the side effect of fulfilling my boyfriend's desire for sexual activity. Additionally, I believed my guilt caused my partner anxiety, because I would willingly consent and then experience guilt during our following sexual activities. I experienced a lot of body shame, which prevented me from taking steps to discover my own personal preferences.
Hmm. I
mean, that's an amazing. It's almost the same thing you were saying.
Yeah, I've encountered that.
Yeah, I dated a Catholic gal. This is 20 years ago after I got divorced. I dated this Catholic gal for about 4 or 5 months, and we would have the most incredible sex for about 2 weeks. And then she'd get in her Catholic guilt cycle. And there was no sex.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd have great sex. I mean, some of the best sex I ever had in my life for 2 weeks, and then the opposite. Well, we almost always came to my place, my house, for sex. We rarely went to hers. One day I showed it at her place, kind of unannounced for whatever reason, I don't remember. And the few times I'd been there, I'd noticed no kinds of religious stuff around. Well, I come in there this time, and she hasn't had time to do anything. And I'm just walking around. I walked in the bedroom, and there's a crucifix up there. There's pictures of Mary and Jesus and all this religious bullshit's there. I think, oh shit, she's been taking this down every time we have sex. And I kind of say, you know, okay, I'll call her Jean for whatever. I say, what's with this taking the religious stuff? She says, I just can't orgasm when Jesus is watching. That's what she said.
Wow, makes it better for me.
That is absolutely hilarious.
Oh, how funny.
Stuff. Can't orgasm when Jesus is watching me.
Well, I've heard on more than one occasion that guys find it more difficult to find a woman to have a very casual sexual relationship with if they know that they're atheist.
You know? Oh, we had folks in this survey tell us, we haven't talked about this, but 54% of our respondents said sex improved after they got rid of religion. 2.2% said it got worse. Well, so we wanted to see, okay, what made it get worse? Because we had this opportunity for people to comment, and you would be surprised. Everybody who said it got worse also commented to tell us. So we looked at this, and we found that we had one guy say, "You know, I could lay any girl in the Sunday school class when I was a Christian. Now they won't talk to me." Or another guy said, "I told my wife I was an atheist, and she stopped sleeping with me. She said I can't sleep with somebody who doesn't share my faith." You know, it's of course it's mostly men because 3/4 of our survey was men.
Right, yeah.
But we had a few women on the opposite side too. So it's access. It's hard to find a mate, especially on the male side, because there's far fewer female atheists out there. Mm-hmm. And that's what we saw in the survey.
That is so weird. So ultimately, what we learn is, through the survey, religiosity has no impact, or almost no impact, on sexual activity. Really, all it impacts is the guilt you feel afterwards.
Which makes you come back to get forgiveness, mm-hmm, and give money and time to that particular God virus.
And other surveys have indicated that while it still doesn't impact your sexuality, it does impact your willingness or ability to take necessary precautions to avoid diseases in pregnancy.
Right.
So ultimately, I think your survey and other surveys that you mentioned have made clear, religion really is having an extraordinarily detrimental effect upon sexual behavior and just in terms of the consequences of sex itself, you know, higher taxes to take care of the children who don't have fathers that they know of, and et cetera, diseases, that kind of stuff. I found this to be an extremely enlightening survey, and I'm glad you did. I think you provided quite a service to understanding of the relationship between sex and religion. And
yeah, I really look forward to the book. It'd be fun.
I really
yeah,
do.
Yeah, yeah, it should really be fun.
It was a lot of fun doing this.
I'll buy it twice and read it once.
See, that's what you need to convince people. Buy two copies so you have one for yourself and a loner copy.
There you go.
That's right. I do need a signed copy.
Well, I learned a long time ago, never loan your signed copy to anyone.
Oh.
Yeah, if you're going to loan a copy, don't loan the signed one. So you need two copies.
Yes.
One signed and one
yes,
not signed.
Yes.
There you go.
Or sign them both, but keep one missing.
Yeah. Sign them both differently.
There you go.
All right, well, I think we explored this in pretty good detail.
Yeah.
Again, ICPPress.com. IPC.
No. ICPC.
IPC.com.
Press.com. Press.com, right?
Well, I'd like to take this time and say thanks for the scotch.
You're welcome, Cole.
Thanks, yes. He needs to sleep this way.
And the cheese. And the crackers.
So I encourage everyone who wants to know more about what we've been talking about, because there's a lot of stuff we didn't talk about.
And sometimes we don't know what we're talking about.
It is a long, in-depth survey. So I advise anyone to take a look at it. It's fascinating. It really is, and I'm looking forward to the book. And thank you for inviting us to your studio.
In the basement.
I made the mistake referring to it as a basement earlier.
You know, hey, that's great down here.
This is not just any basement.
No, this is great.
It's a
nice
studio.
Nice and cool.
Shame on me.
Like a library, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, there's more than three books down here.
And, you know, this was fun. And everybody who listened, thanks for listening. And
yeah, all five of you.
There's more than five. There are more than five. So, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
See you later.